Welcome to the Energizing India podcast, a program that focuses on the electric mobility industry in India and how to bring about rapid change to this sector. My name is Ravin Mirchandani, and over the next few months, this program will cover intimate conversations with key protagonists within the entire ecosystem of the industry in India. Previously, we've featured deep insights from the CEO of India's largest charge point operator, Magenta Charge Grid, and also the CEO of NextCharge, a joint venture in India between Exide and Le Clancher, which will soon inaugurate a large battery plant to make lithium-ion batteries in India. Today, we focus on one of the key vehicle OEMs that is bringing about very rapid and palpable change to this sector in India by fostering dissonance and swimming against the current of conventional wisdom. Innovations in India typically lean towards the e-commerce and service industries, with multiple startups springing up in these sectors over the past decade. However, there is one startup that went against the trend and ventured into the more capital-intensive sector of design and manufacturing, leading the path towards decarbonized mobility in India, but also at the same time making that mobility really very cool. Aether Energy is changing the game in India, changing the game in the Indian two-wheeler market with its A450X scooter, which is completely electric and runs on lithium-ion batteries. Aether is in effect the Tesla of the two-wheeler mobility market in India, demonstrating that an electric bike need not compromise on looks, range, speed, or safety. It is going to be indeed a very interesting ride to watch. Aether Energy going from strength to strength over the next few years with all the dissonance they're bringing about to this industry sector. Today, we welcome on the program Tarun Mehta, one of the co-founders of Aether Energy. Tarun, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tarun. Thanks for having me.
Tarun, you have a very interesting background. You went to the premier school in India, the Indian Institute of Technology in Madras, doing a dual degree in engineering design. Then you interned in some of the most interesting companies in the automotive sector, in Mercedes-Benz, even BHEL. You worked for a short while in Ashok Leyland, a while so short you could even call that an internship, before launching Aether Energy.
You've been shorter than my internship.
Is exactly right, even shorter than your internships. You were student president during your time at IIT Madras on the entrepreneurship cell. And obviously all of that has proven beneficial given the success you've had from the day you've launched Aether Energy to today. Take us through your journey. Tell us about your background, Tarun. Who is Tarun?
I grew up in Ahmedabad. Parents and a lot of the family still there. Then got an admitted in IIT Madras, moved to Chennai for that. This was a dual degree course, so bachelor's and master's put together, 5-year course. I think I selected this, this department was Department of Engineering Design. It was a new department in IIT. Took it up because the name had Master's in Automotive Engineering in it, which turned out to be a little bit of a mistake because you never actually were given a degree in automotive, but like that's how we were brought it. So yeah, just got in there, went to college, had 5 fantastic years, met my co-founder Swapnil in college, and essentially the way I would describe my 5 years at college is we built a lot of stuff. Learned a little bit about startups and played a bunch of video games. That's a reasonably good description of what you did in college.
Excellent. It looks like everything you did was actually taking you to the Aether Energy journey, wasn't it? All your internships, all the club memberships, even the video games in the end were about making the dashboard of the Aether scooter. Take us through the journey of a startup in the manufacturing sector in India. You know, you've gone from 45 lakhs as your seed funding from IIT to 1 million from the Bunsells, then to an additional amount of money from Tiger Global, was it? And finally, the Hero Motor Corporation. So what has this journey been like? You've obviously been incredibly successful. Tell us what happened.
I think the journey has been characterized by an acute lack of real-world awareness of what automotive businesses are. That's really helped us a lot. I think, and I've said this multiple times to our teams, if you really knew how hard it is to actually build an automotive company, there's no chance in hell we would have actually started up. If we actually knew, we were pretty naive. back in 2013, back in 2014, when we had just started up 2014, and we were thinking of how we're going to build this product. So I remember even all the way till early 2015, our plans were 25 people, maybe 35 people, and a couple million dollars in funding should be good enough to move to manufacturing and become an automotive OEM. I think forget people with experience. I think even if you thought really long and hard about it, you would probably find a lot of holes in what our plan, master plan was. But that really helped, actually, because the journey was always going to be long. What we were going to do was more than manufacturing. And manufacturing is a journey, honestly, that we've only started in the last 2 years. The first 5 years was a pretty massive design and engineering journey. And because the way we thought, the way we saw the opportunity, you're not just trying to build an electric vehicle. You're not just trying to build an OEM. The journey to build this out, the journey has always been to build an energy company. And for us, building vehicles has been step one. Now, and the way we saw it, the opportunity here was that nobody's going to take the effort of actually building the entire technology stack. Building batteries, building BMS, building charging, building a complete new platform for an electric vehicle, rethinking frames, rethinking the entire software, whether firmware or the cloud stack, everything. Nobody's going to build all these pieces out. And therein lies the opportunity. If all these pieces had been built out by suppliers, then we could have just picked everything up. But in that case, many others could have picked everything up. And we would have had no chance in hell to actually build an OEM. But the fact here was that there are very few suppliers, like there are very few partners in the industry. There are very few people like you who are actually like building stuff out and actually getting them to the market. And that still remains like the reality. There are only a pretty handful of players and they're all at a very early stage. So do you have like a Bosch and a Continental with like decades of experience in every single part of the technology, trillions of kilometers clocked over maybe hundreds of different models for every single little piece of tech that exists? No. And it's not like I'm not blaming suppliers, it's just that that's where the industry is. It's super, super early stages. So we saw an opportunity that, okay, what if we built out every single part of this? That'll be fun. That'll allow us to actually have a very different type of mode. And maybe in the journey, we could build out a very fantastic product. So that's how things began. Like the way we saw it, we honestly did not think manufacturing, we did not think distribution, we did not think operations. In step one, all we are saying is, let's build a fantastic product and let's build it all ourselves. Right? So we've got to build the frame, we're going to rethink the frame. You're not going to build a steel frame. Like everybody builds steel frames. We'll build a different frame. We'll build an aluminium frame. How? Well, we've got to figure it out. We're not going to just buy a battery pack. We're going to build a battery pack. We're going to build a BMS. We're going to build a charger. We're going to build a home charger. We're going to build a fast charger. And obviously, if you do all of this, it just makes sense. We're going to have a connected vehicle. So we're going to... So initially we thought we'll buy an XS7 tablet, stick it to the vehicle, and then we said, oh, that doesn't seem to work. So what we'll do is, oh, let's build our own tablet. How hard can it be? So we actually started, we went all the way up to selecting the processor, selecting the RAM, selecting, like doing the entire PCB layout. And we've done it a few times now. It was an interesting journey. I think I would say a solid 4 years from mid-2014 to mid-2018. Was only engineering design. It's only post mid-2018, end 2018, that really the operations part of this business really kind of dawned on us. And that's when we realized, oh, okay, to do all of this, we actually need a lot of different, really strong partners in our supply chain. We need actually a sourcing team, we actually need quality, we need manufacturing, we have to actually set up a good plant, we have to worry about incoming quality, all that good stuff, right? Last 2 years, that's what we've been doing. And it's only now, in the seventh year of our life as a startup, that we've actually started thinking about distribution. We've been building this in an extremely against all the grains of startup advice. We didn't crack distribution on day one or year seven also. We only started working on distribution now. So once at a time, design came first, manufacturing came after. And now it's all just about distribution here.
You said so much and so many things came into my mind, so many questions coming back at you. The latest investment that you had was about distribution, wasn't it? It was about taking you through an existing OEM distribution channel. And I'd like to touch on that. But before we go there, through the design and then the manufacturing and now the distribution journey, the whole startup journey, which part did you enjoy the most, Tarun?
Yeah, every part's been very exciting. I think the manufacturing part's probably been the hardest till now. It's just because of the timing and just because of the fact that we come with so little experience there. We brought in some great teams. We brought in some really fantastic individuals. But the biggest learning that we had in manufacturing was that until the founders are willing to sort of roll up the sleeves and do a lot of these pieces ourselves, it's very hard to build a new institution out. It's very hard to build an institution out by just hiring experience. You can hire experience, you can hire learnings once you know what you want to do. But you can't hire experience and ask them, what should we do? Understandably so. So I think manufacturing has probably been our hardest piece to not to solve. And it's a piece that is still, honestly, still solving. What's been the most fun? So in every piece has a different one. Some of the fondest memories have come from the very early stages, 2014, when we were building these hacky prototypes that didn't really even go much. Actually, I would say this is late 2013, early 2014, when we were literally just assembling anything. And that was the phase when all we were trying to do was actually prove to ourselves that, you know what, we could somehow assemble something that looks like a scooter, which will run on an electrical motor and run on a battery pack that we would have built, and the thing will run and it will be fun to ride. Right? Like there's this barrier. It's very hard to explain because it's not objective, it's not rational. Like my co-founder has been the head of has been one of the founding members of our college's FSA team. So he has built race cars, right? So, but it's really hard to explain. Despite that, and despite like all the prototyping experience that we had with both of us and really fantastic team that we had at the start, there was still this barrier that, and I can't describe what the barrier was, except that when we built that first prototype out and the thing ran, and it ran really well. Okay, like the thing was not even anywhere close to the spec of what we finally built. Okay, this thing was not like 80 kilometers per hour. This thing was like 50 kilometers per hour. Okay, this thing was like small, puny. But when it actually ran, and some of the early things that we wanted to test, okay, imagine having a touch screen on your dashboard. So we actually stuck an Nexus 7 tablet there, right? Imagine having really instantaneous acceleration. Imagine having not a hub motor, but a flame. So some of these really early stage decisions. The fact that we built our own battery pack as just two students with no company, no money. Right? We built our own battery pack, and the thing is that I think something sort of flipped, and it kind of gave us the confidence that, you know what, maybe we can actually build a complete company. Maybe we could actually build something bigger or better than a Hero, Bajaj, or a DBS. I think that confidence was super critical. And I think in that sense, building the first prototype was so magical. So I think that's probably my most exciting stage in the startup's life.
Tarun, you made a very interesting statement there, which was gold, in fact, for anybody in the startup sphere. You said you can't hire experience and then ask them what to do. You've got to do it the other way around. That's just pure gold. You, in effect, have started the Tesla of the two-wheeler manufacturing world. In a sense, you went through the same journey as Elon Musk, isn't it? You faced hurdles all along the way, and you decided to be vertically integrated and do everything yourself. You've made a comment twice on the battery. You said you decided to build your own battery pack. Can you tell us what that is? What are you exactly doing for the Ather 450 scooter in terms of battery?
So what we do is we buy standard form factor cells, now 21700 cells that exist out there. Our team does the selection, selects the right chemistry, works out with the right partner. And then we pick up these cells, typically in a battery pack like this will be anywhere between 120 to maybe 200 cells. actually not 200 now, actually closer to 150, 160 cells now. You take these cells and then we've designed a casing, something that can take the heat, dissipate it. So there's an aluminium casing. It obviously provides a lot of structural rigidity to the battery pack, but it also is connected to the rest of the vehicle, which is all aluminium. So it also allows for a quicker transfer of heat from the cells to the casing and then to the rest of the vehicle, allowing for a better heat dissipation. So we designed the casing, we designed the packaging, we designed the sealing. We designed it for it to be waterproof, for it to... there's a lot of compounds that we use inside the battery pack to help absorb the heat faster. So the design of the manufacturing system to sort of assemble all of this, and then finally the battery management system that controls the power both ways, charging and discharge. And I think that's pretty much it. I think that's what a battery pack's design is. Design the casing, take care of the heating, take care of your any EMI issues, given that the BMS is there, make sure it's waterproof, make sure it's rugged enough, and you're good to go.
So batteries, staying with the lithium-ion batteries, the biggest barrier to the growth in this industry for a long time was the range anxiety for EVs and also the cost of EVs because the cost of batteries was so high. You have in many ways addressed both. You have looked at a range of 90 kilometers and you've got people who've been able to get to speeds of over 90 kilometers an hour. So what was the journey of addressing cost versus range when you were looking at your battery design, battery pack?
So actually, while the vehicle has a stated range of 85 kilometers and our customers have done comfortably more than 100 now, some customers have done 130 in the previous generations, I expect. Those customers will probably touch 140, 145 in the new generation. But having said all of that, honestly, I'm somebody who thinks that the first wave of electric vehicles in the country, especially in the two-wheeler segment, don't have the problem of range anxiety. That's what I think. I definitely think that in the scooter space. I think range anxiety is a concept that we have just borrowed from cars in the US. Indian customers don't drive 30 kilometers to go to the nearest Walmart to buy stuff. We do 25 kilometers a day. 30 kilometers is really the upper edge. Somebody doing 50 kilometers is probably using the scooter as their primary livelihood. In people doing more than 70, 80 kilometers, I don't really know them. Like even delivery boys in places like Bangalore struggle to clock 80 kilometers a day. So we always believed in this, which is why the original concept of the vehicle was only to build 60 kilometers of range. We bumped that up to 75 because by the time we got to production, cell chemistry had just improved. So what we thought will give us 60 kilometers kind of matured to doing 75 by the time we got to production. And that was great, but that was really not what the core business asked us. And kind of staying with the theme, as the technology improved, the 75 became 85. But honestly, I would still put my money that a 60 to 70 kilometer range vehicle, a scooter, is good enough for the first wave of electric vehicles that will be sold right now. Obviously, there is a market, and I don't know if it is like 50% of the market or 70% of the market. There's a large market that sits that will probably flip once scooters cross the 100 kilometer range barrier and they cross it consistently. I mean, like already our certified ranges are more than 100 kilometers, but I mean, a city ranges, like the actual numbers that people will get with a bunch of duals, triples happening. Once that number is north of 100, a lot of people will start switching in large numbers. But the reality is those people are not going to buy electric vehicles today. Those people are going to wait. They are early adopters. They're not early adopters. They are the majority customers, right? Early adopters, I firmly believe 60 to 75 kilometers range is a good number. Everything beyond that is great to have, but it's not a real need for the market. So that's how we always thought about range. And that's how we thought about cost. So our costs were always built for a vehicle that will do something between 60 to 75. Everything that we've gotten above that has been a little bit of a free journey and we're glad to have it. But as long as it does not increase cost. If it increases cost, we would rather cut down on range and actually drop cost.
That makes sense.
So that's how we thought.
So when you started your journey, in fact, it was going to be a swappable battery, which is the way China started. And there was a big push even from IIT Madras, from the cell there that was working on swappable batteries for that being the standard in India. And that's now gone a little bit by the wayside. What happened there? Why did you change your strategy from swap to fast charge?
because I could convince customers to actually buy it. So people will tell you within Ether that for the longest time, I was the lone voice fighting this war that we should build swappable batteries. And we had a bunch of people to sort of build that entire thing out. The reason the battery packs were on the floorboard was because one of the reasons was we could do a very quick drop. So the swap was designed to be a quick drop operation with a little bit of automation built in. And the battery pack was built to be only mounted on four boards, which could be assembled and disassembled very quickly with some automation. And the idea was that this will be a swappable battery pack with a drop down operation. It kind of made logical sense that obviously it solves the problem of charging speeds, it solves the problem of upfront cost, range, as I mentioned, I never thought that could be a real problem, but sure, it kind of also technically solves that problem. And we built out at least one or two prototypes with a swappable battery pack. We tried, so logically it all made sense. I think even investors and our professors at IIT Madras, everybody liked it, everybody believed that this was the future. Some of us had a nagging worry that it wasn't making real sense. Until we built out these prototypes and we kind of stayed with them for a while. Until I changed when I started doing the swap operation. What I realized is that the batteries weighed 16 to 17 kilograms. Right now, so obviously the idea was we'll split this into two battery packs, but the thing still weighs 8 kgs each, right? How many people did I know who would happily lift an 8 kg battery pack out of a scooter, put it on a rack somewhere, lift out another 8 kg battery pack out of that rack and put it back in the vehicle and do it twice and do it maybe every day, right? That's a very hard ask. I tried doing it myself. A lot of us tried doing it. You could do it, right? But would you want to do it? No, you wouldn't want to do it. You would do it in your excitement of electric vehicle maybe 5 times. The 6th time, you'd already start thinking, this is stupid. An Activa is so much simpler. Like, I don't need to like lift luggage all around. Like, this does not make any sense. And the reason it took us such a long time to figure this out is because customers never tell you this, right? Like, customers are not thinking this through. What customers would tell us is, hey, listen, like, give us swappable battery packs. I can carry it to my house on the 8th floor. Brilliant. Like, you would all get excited, primed up, and listen, that's the voice of customer. That's what people want, really, right? Like, that's what we should build swappable battery packs. Until you build it, and you kind of imagine living on the 8th floor, and then, okay, so what's going to happen? Like, am I going to lift an 8 kg battery pack, trail it along with me, take it in the lift, go to my house on the 8th floor, ring the bell, go inside, dock it somewhere, charge it, for what? An additional 30 kilometer of range, that does not make sense. It's a lot of work. And who's going to do it? So I imagine my family. Would my dad do it? No, well, he's 55. He'll probably have a back pain if he does this every day. Right? Forget two battery packs. Even if he did one, he will soon enough develop a back pain. Give my mom do it? No chance. My mom can't lift something this heavy. Would my sister do it? Are you kidding me? Like, my sister's not going to carry around battery packs every day. Like, they're all going to curse me, right? They're all going to be like, stupid aadmi, kya khaida isne ye, right? Like, problem kya the Activa mein dekho. So, I could, like, unless you were a fanatic, like, no, I have to buy an electric only, okay, however bad the experience is, you would buy this thing. So then I thought, okay, maybe people won't take their battery packs up to their houses. Maybe, you know, what we'll do is we'll think up, instead of a large infrastructure, like a massive swapping infrastructure all across the city, and we will do manual, we will do automated swaps. Well, then we read about Battery Better Place, and then we read about Tesla's own experiments with automated swap stations. And then we thought of our own designs and realized this thing is going to be expensive. And we are living in India. This thing is going to be breaking down all the time, like all the bloody time. It's going to take us 10 years before this thing is like, several years before things is really stable. So automation is not going to work out on day one. And if it does not work out on day one, then it's not going to work out at all, right? So maybe we'll have to start with a manual operation. So we'll set up swap stations, have a lot of operators swap out batteries manually. Boom, the cost went out of whack immediately, right? Because if you set up 100 battery station catering to maybe 200 people, and you had two operators in two ships who will do these manual swaps, and you paid both of them about even minimum wage or like something better than minimum wage, people, let's say 15, 16,000 rupees each, especially in the bigger urban areas. And then these are lithium-ion batteries put up in a place, right? You can't just leave them be. So in your third shift, you're going to have security deployed, right? right? You're probably going to need more than one security. You're probably going to need securities in two shifts. When you just take the cost of these people and load them onto the cost of the battery packs that you're going to charge people, and then you realize that, oh, you can't just have, if you have 200 scooters in the field, you can't just have 200 batteries. You will need an additional 100 batteries for them, right? So these 100 batteries will have to be paid for by these guys. Because unlike the sharing economy, I can't do something else with these batteries somewhere else, right? Like 200 batteries already logged on those scooters and these 100 have to be available.
True.
When I added all these costs, the cost of per kilometer was way higher than the cost of petrol scooters. Like way higher. Like assuming $100 a kilowatt hour cell cost that will somehow happen the next year, assuming that we have serious economics of scale, even then, like the operational cost of all this, like was almost like such a huge cost that did not make sense. So, and then we tried it. We tried it with about, I think, 30 customers. We told them, you want swapping, right? Obviously, I want swapping. Like swapping makes sense. Please give me swapping batteries. Okay. So we're going to charge you about 2,500 rupees a month, unlimited swaps. Like, oh, no, that doesn't make sense. What's the cost of battery EMI? That's about 1,300 rupees. I would probably pay you 1,400 rupees, 1,500 rupees if I'm feeling generous. Like people that want to pay for that cost, right? So, sorry, long story, but between just the sheer ergonomic difficulties and the automation and the infrastructure difficulties, and then finally the cost realities, I kind of realized that for a consumer segment, building out swapping was not making sense. It would make sense for B2B, but we are not in the B2B space, so we can't back out of doing swapping.
So let's talk a little bit about policy then. We like to look at the whole ecosystem on this program. And there's parts of the government that really are pushing very hard. You know, Minister Gadkari came out and said he wanted everything electric by 2030, all two-wheelers electric by the middle of this decade. And that, of course, created a lot of consternation amongst the larger OEMs. I remember even reading one of the CEOs, one of the larger OEMs, saying these sorts of policies only help the small startups and don't take cognizance of the big part that larger OEM two-wheeler manufacturers play in India. If you were to be able to have a very candid conversation with the Prime Minister of India on the one question, what needs to be done to make this sector really have some rocket fuel and change the way we live and move about in India over the next 3 years, what would you say? What would you do in that position?
I would suggest two things. First, I would suggest required by law setting up of 15 amp sockets in every single parking lot, whether apartment complex or office complexes. We need the urban development ministry, or we need the housing development, whatever the right ministry is, to require setting up of 15 amp sockets in every single parking lot. That, while that is still not limiting the industry today, because honestly, the industry is still selling to early adopters and will be selling to early adopters for the next maybe even 2 years. But as we grow into more cities, as electric vehicles become more mainstream, Tata is building them, Hyundai is building them, we are building them, Bajaj is launching them. It's only a matter of very little time that an average customer is suddenly starting to get very curious about electric, right? And very seriously starting to consider them. At that point, we'll start running into serious problems with no clear guideline as to how do you set up a charging point in your parking lot. And associations will be forced to, without being really evil, deny a lot of those requests because they don't know how to handle them. So we need the government to really, really make this a compulsion. It's not super expensive. It's typically going to cost about 1,200 to 1,500 rupees, tapping from a meter directly. It is not very different from the legislation that came 20 years back, which required setting up of post boxes at the entrance of every single apartment complex. It's a simple thing, right? Probably costs like a few hundred bucks per post box. I think we need something similar to come in now. Now is the right time because the way the common machinery will move, it will take 2 years before those points really start coming in. So hence, now is a good time. The second thing that I would say is the industry's frustration is understandable because the IC engine industry has a lot of investments in this world. But what the government can rely on is that the two-wheeler companies have a lot of are cash rich. They're not debt-ridden. They're not financially weak. They all understand that this is the future. I think the government needs to sort of get everybody together and get them to realize that the reason our two-wheeler industry needs to go electric is not just because environmental reasons, anything else. It's because of sheer competition. Today, the Indian two-wheeler company is the best globally. Indian two-wheeler industry is the best globally. We are one of the largest exporters out there. We have a serious reputation with our vehicles in Africa, in Latin America, in parts of Asia. These are good vehicles that are getting exported, right? Bajaj, TVS, Honda, even Hero, like really strong reputations. Obviously, large players in India, but even outside. We stand to lose the most with vehicles going electric. If Indian companies don't make the transition today, they will not just lose the crown outside in exports to China or Taiwan. We will really open ourselves to some incredible amount of competition even locally. And that'll be a shame because that's probably one of the last few industries where India today is still a manufacturing powerhouse. Everything else, including freaking needles, we are not really good any longer than India. Two-wheeler manufacturing, every part of the supply chain in India is a true powerhouse. Like the reason we've been able to set up as a newcomer a complete supply chain is honestly because we're standing on the shoulders of what the larger players have built and grown as capability and competence in India over the last several decades. We stand to lose all of it as the market goes electric. And hence it stands to reason that like the larger players like a Hero and a Honda and a Bajaj and a TVS invest today in electric. They use the cash reserves that they've built over the last few decades and plow them towards going electric right today. I don't think the government should change anything on its stance. In fact, if anything, the government should probably push a series of incentives on the supply chain side. Create a massive incentive for every global supplier or any supplier, right? Local, global, anywhere, to basically set up electric vehicle supply chain in India. Right? Like flood the heck out of those incentives, right? Like give them free land, give them tax rebates, give them free machinery imports, give them everything, right? Like if somebody is planning to sell their components to somebody in Indonesia, they should think of India as the hub. They should be setting up the plant in India because it's so goddamn cheap, right? Flood the market with so many suppliers in India that the OEMs have an added incentive to go electric faster. The rest, competition between all of them will take care of. Right? But create enough incentive for the supply chain to really come up in India. I think that's what the government should do in a big way. I think the government has done a fantastic job on the demand side. I think the supply side is what could do with a little bit of boost.
So it's a testimony to your journey, Tarun, that Hero Motors made an investment in the company. And I want to talk about that a little bit, but there's two things going on in my head. The first is $30 million for 30% of the company. And, you know, that's an enormous valuation for Aether that puts you at $100 million pre-money. I'm interested how that journey was for you, first to arrive at that valuation, and secondly, to also almost be at that Apple having Microsoft as an investor moment, 20 years ago, because here's a large OEM coming in. I know there's a lot of synergies because their distribution network is really going to be the rocket fuel for you. And they're obviously going to learn from you. But what was going on in your head when you got to this valuation and this partner investing in your company?
I think what we realized is that this is late 2016, and we realized that we still have about a year and a half worth of more work to do to get the vehicle to production. It turned out to be almost close to 2 years eventually. And we realized that for a traditional venture capital investor to be able to understand this business is going to be hard because unlike a software and internet business, we can't show many of those metrics. We can't show installs, we can't show user engagement, we can't show, even if it is free, a lot of traction, right? We will have zero traction and then we'll certainly have $100 million in revenue. So, and that is a world that a lot of VCs are not exposed to. So while we were lucky that somebody like Tiger came in early and backed us for $12 million, we kind of took a call that it's going to be unlikely that you're going to see a lot of repeat of that over multiple successive rounds. And we definitely felt that the company is going to need a sizable amount of capital still. Like at that point when Hero came in, we had only raised $13 million total. And we kind of felt that we will probably need somewhere between $40 to $50 million more before this thing is really stable in production. Even that number turned out to be much higher. So with all these factors put together, it kind of made sense to bring in Hero as an investor. Hero has been a fantastic investor. There is no operational or strategic overlap that we need to create today. So in almost every way, they've remained a financial investor. Obviously, this opens up an opportunity for both of us to look at synergies sometime down the line. But what he really brought on was a lot of super patient capital. And what we knew very certainly is that if he did not take super patient capital now, we're likely to go down a path where we'll end up compromising and probably dying before any of this really comes out. So it makes sense to bring in Hero as an investor back in 2017, early 2017.
It sounds very strategic, yes. So here's the big question for you then, Tarun. Is 2021 the year that most people in India will be buying their last ICE two-wheeler?
Oh, interesting question. Last ICE two-wheeler. I think, I wish I could say that truly, but I do believe that the incumbents are not going to shift out in the next year. And just given the market size, I don't think even if you wanted to, startups could ramp up our capacities that fast. So I wish, but I think maybe with the exception of a few cities, maybe like Bangalore, Hyderabad, most cities will continue seeing ICE engine sales continue for at least another 2-3 years comfortably.
So I meant from the perspective of if you're buying in 2021, you'll replace it in 2024. So, you know, the people... The people who are buying a two-wheeler in 2021, those people will likely never be buying an ICE two-wheeler ever again.
Oh, definitely. Like, there is no chance that people buying an ICE scooter or bike now are going to be buying another ICE vehicle, because by the time their purchase cycle comes through again, your 4-5 year period, there's no way that IC engines will be anything beyond a little bit of a fantasy purchase, a little bit of a iconic or you know, like a
collector's
thing,
a collector's item.
Edition. Yes.
Excellent. Tarun, it has been so interesting talking to you today to learn about the journey of Aether Energy, one of India's premier startups. What a journey, 2013 to 2020, to go from a concept in an IIT lab to being the preeminent electric vehicle mover in the country. Your view on what the government needs to do, like the postbox legislation, to make sure that there's a 15 amp plug available everywhere, at every new building, at every shopping center, at every petrol station, really something we hadn't thought about before. And your views also on this whole vertical integration and the need for a startup to be able to make everything itself, because it just doesn't exist. And if it does exist, it's far too expensive, because the people you're subcontracting to are going to recover their entire engineering cost on you rather than across the ecosystem. And finally, my big takeaway in a startup, you can't hire experience and ask them what to do. You've got to know what to do yourself, roll your sleeves up and get the work done, and have a good team supporting you along the way. It's been an absolute pleasure, Tarun. I can't wait for us to be able to travel again, to come down to Bangalore and have a coffee with you. Thank you so much for making the time, Tarun.
Tarun, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for having me over the episode. And I really look forward to meeting you in person sometimes.
In our podcast series so far, we've talked previously to the CEO of India's largest charge point operator and also India's largest lithium-ion battery manufacturer. Today, we talked to the CEO of India's largest electric two-wheeler manufacturer, a company that has been dissonant in creating lots of change in the e-mobility space in India. In our next podcast, we'll talk to the CEO of India's largest e-rickshaw three-wheeler manufacturer. And we look forward to seeing you on the program then. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast today, make sure to follow us on whatever platform you're hearing us on, whether it's our own website, Spotify, Apple iTunes, or alternative. Thank you very much, and see you on our next episode.